This is tape three, side one. Professor, Emeritus Professor of Music, Howard Karp, April 12th, 2006. So you were saying your first sabbatical was almost an automatic.
Well, yes. Certainly the Fulbright grant was not an automatic thing. I had applied for that, and I know I was in competition with other very, very fine people. But it was interesting that another member of our department in Kentucky received, and in music, received a Fulbright grant to Vienna that same year, and that was really very unusual.
So, and you got a Fulbright also.
So there were two of us from the same
Kentucky.
Department.
Wow.
Yes, and the same place. So I felt very fortunate to have that because it was just a dream to go to Vienna all my life, just to think about going to Vienna where so many of these great composers lived, you know, Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn and Schubert and Brahms. It was just endless. There was always that very congenial home.
Yes.
It's such a historical city, and so much of it, you can go and find those places where these people lived, the so-called Geburtshauses, the houses where these people lived or were born,
mm-hmm.
Are like lovely museums. And every time I would return to Vienna, I would go to those places. And it was always a bit inspirational. I'll never forget walking into Beethoven's home one of his homes across from the university today. In Beethoven's time, it was just a moat with a high wall, he had the apartment on the top floor, so it was like four stories high. And each step, I just couldn't believe I was walking in the footsteps of Beethoven.
Wow!
It was like some religious experience.
Uh-huh.
I remember having that experience when I went to Leipzig and visited the Thomaskirche of where Bach worked, his last position. You know, that was just unbelievable. I mean, we heard his music being played inside the church, and we looked at each other, and we had tears in our eyes.
Yes.
You know, just that way. I had that experience in Bonn at the Beethoven birth house.
Really, a sacred moment.
A sacred moment. Yes, indeed.
Now, Howard, the year that you and Francis went then would be
1960-61. And it was a wonderful, wonderful year for us. Our children we went when they were 5 and 3. And Perry did first grade there at the American school. And Christopher went to a Catholic kindergarten just down at the end of the block, and he had a wonderful teacher. He was very afraid of the nuns because they wore severe habits, and he thought they were witches.
Yes.
His teacher happened to be a lay teacher who became a cloistered nun later in her life. By the time we returned to Vienna 7 years later, she was a cloistered nun. And 7 years later, she was working in an office, but she told us at the end of the year that she was contemplating becoming a nun, and we did see her once in Dachau, of all places.
Oh my gosh.
And the cloistered convent was there because of the concentration camp. Their convent was on the site where the SS officers had their barracks, and people would come and pray and leave money for the nuns to pray for the departed. It was very moving,
indeed,
to see that. And, because we knew her, we got to stay in the convent overnight.
Oh my!
And we played a concert for them, but that's. I was at the University of Wisconsin by then, when we went back, because we were in Innsbruck, which is fairly close to Munich and Dachau. And we didn't get a direct call because we couldn't communicate with her. And when it was rather circuitous, we received a call back in America that was forwarded to us from someone that she knew. And somehow she had learned that we were in the area and she wanted to invite us. But when we were there together, everything that she asked for, she had to ask the Mother Superior for first. So it was very regimented. One would think that would be true. But fortunately, there were other young nuns in the group. We were afraid that she would just be the only young person taking those strict orders. And there would be a generation gap. But there were quite a few younger people. So that was something.
Indeed. Yeah. Howard, when you were in Vienna, 1961, were you performing publicly or were you just studying?
I did some. I was basically studying and I was basically listening to music and I was drinking it all in, and we would go to concert night after night after night and opera, and I've never heard so many concerts in a row by such quality and quantity, you know, at the same time. It was just thrilling. It was just thrilling.
So Vienna
and
was
everything was so inexpensive for us because the dollar was so strong.
Yeah.
And then it was like 26 shillings to a dollar. And we could stand at the opera for 35 cents, you know, each. It was, and you meet the nicest people in the standing room only live. The nicest people in Vienna seem to be the people who don't have a lot of money and just love music so intensively that they will sacrifice to go, because you know that they'll just do anything to hear music. It's not all just foreigners that go, but many of the interesting, our children introduced many of their classmates to the opera and to concerts in Vienna. And you know, we just assumed that all Viennese school children would be going to hear the opera.
Yeah.
And they had the idea, oh no, that's not for us, that's for foreigners. Because, you know, it was such a bulwark of the economics there, and the government subsidized the cultural aspects of Vienna to bring in the tourists, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that our children, especially the second year, when they were like 11 and 12 mm-hmm. and so forth, their classmates would come with them to the opera. They were hearing opera for the first time. They were just surrounded by it, but they felt that was just for adults and maybe people from other parts of the world.
Howard, I think of Vienna in 1960 as, you know, really still coming out of World War II and hard times. But listening to you, you make it sound like culturally it was still very strong.
Oh, it was very strong, yes. You know, I think a decade earlier it would have been very different. I think that it would still have been the ruins from the bombings apparent. See, when I was just beginning, faculty member, say at the University of Kentucky, my boss had a research Fulbright to Vienna, and he told us about, you know, the buildings that were down. The opera was closed; it was still being reconstructed.
Uh-huh.
So, but the opera went on at the Theater an der Wien, the house where Fidelio was first performed.
Uh-huh.
I believe the Magic Flute, Mozart was first performed there. But it was reconstructed because near the, I think in 1944, an American bombing team mistook the opera house for the railroad station.
Uh-huh.
And blew it to smithereens. And the interesting thing is that the Viennese spent so many millions and millions of shillings to reproduce the opera just as it was when they reconstructed it they made it a little larger in the in the back for the stage and for the storing of scenery and such things. But it's basically the old building, just and so they didn't change the tradition at all by building a modern opera house, which would have cost much less. They really went all out to make it as if the war never happened. So just fascinating.
And you liked, you enjoyed the life in Vienna.
Very much, very much. Yeah. And I enjoyed the other Fulbrighters, not necessarily just in music, but in the other fields too. They were just wonderful. And the Fulbright Commission was so wonderful. They were just so helpful. And so it was a wonderful arrangement, I'd say, for talented American students to study in a foreign country and really become conversant in a foreign language.
So what did you have to do, if anything, at the end of that year?
Well, you had to write up what you did. But I received half of my salary, and the other half was kind of made up in a way. Remember, I was getting very, very little, even after 6 years of teaching. I mean, by today's standards. But we were just living in a society where it just didn't cost much for an American. We live in a very comfortable house. There was a gardener and his wife who lived in a smaller house on the grounds and kept up and kept people out that we didn't want to come in, because he especially was a fireman, a former fireman on the railroad, and he was very curmudgeonly, and he loved keeping people out. And there was a fence around the house, which helped keep them out. But he was just the kind that loved his domain. I noticed the people behind a desk in Vienna, say in the post office, or in a bureau or in an office, people who have to give you a stamp of approval on your visa or whatever, they like to make you sweat a little. I don't think that's quite true in America. I noticed that when foreigners come to this country, I think they're treated very well by the people behind the desk that have to give you permission. And when you go to a post office here, I think people bend over backwards to be polite and to help you.
Yes.
But in Vienna, it was very different. And perhaps it had something to do with the vestiges of the monarchy. But everyone was in their own little domain, and they were the keeper of that domain. And if you had to get a stamp of approval, whether it was for a postage or whether it was for your something important like registration, they like to lord it over you a little and like to make you sweat a little. Because it was always an argument that would ensue, and
interesting.
It was just something that I felt.
So you finish your year, mm-hmm. and you return in the summer of 61 to Kentucky.
Yes, and that was I was obligated to do that. Not that I didn't want to, mm-hmm. but I had nothing else. But while I was there in Europe, I made friends with the violinist who was on a sabbatical leave, the Hungarian violinist who was on a sabbatical leave from the University of Illinois.
Oh.
And he told me, and we gave many concerts together, sponsored by the U.S. Cultural Affairs Department there, and we played throughout the country, and they even sent him to Hungary, so we got to go to his native, and that was the first time that he returned to his native country. He had been away since 1938. He first came to America with three others in a string quartet, three other Hungarian guys, and all four of them were caught in the war that started in Europe the following year, and they couldn't go back. And that was their saving grace, because they all made a tremendous success in this country. And I think they started at the Westminster School in Princeton.
Uh-huh.
but they were just to be here for 1 year and then return to their native country, and then that was the luck of the times for them, because they couldn't go back, because if they went back they might not have survived.
Right.
And they all had very successful careers in this country. And like my partner was Paul Rowland, and we played for 12 years together, you know.
Really?
Because he recommended me for the position of Illinois. He said there were two piano positions that would be opening up.
Oh, and, while you were in Vienna, he told you this.
He told us about the next year. Two people who had 10 years or 40 years were about to retire. See, in those years, you had to retire at a certain age.
Yes.
Today, one can go as long as one wishes. And one hopes one's wise enough to retire when one should and not continue after. So I retired when I was almost 71. Uh-huh. So I would have felt uncomfortable to stay on. I realized I was one of the oldest, if not the oldest, on the faculty. But at one time I was the youngest, and that was when I was at Kentucky. I was the youngest on the faculty. After one more year at Illinois, I had this, I auditioned for the position a whole year in advance.
You knew you wanted to go to Illinois.
A much greater institution for music and many other things, but I knew that that Kentucky was, there were 48 states in those years, and we were ranked number 47 in education. Just in general education, Kentucky was near the bottom. They would say, thank God for Arkansas, because Arkansas was considered the 48th state, and we had that number of states. And I knew that there would be many more talented people in music at the university. And it was a much bigger department,
yes,
and a much more developed department. And it was a place that I knew I would really have to prove my mettle, so to speak. I was going to a place that would require more, because the responsibilities would be greater. And that certainly proved the case. It was a very, very different environment, much more professional, if you would. There were many more gifted people.
So did you teach one more year at Kentucky?
Yes.
And then go?
In 62, I went, although I was hired in 61, but it was for the fall of 62.
Uh-huh.
I was very happy that I made the move. Mm-hmm. You know, I love my time at Kentucky, but I knew this was a good time to make the move, and I was hoping that I would be up to the position. And they advanced me very fast. I became a full professor at the University of Illinois.
And tenure as well?
Yeah. Oh, I had tenure. After 1 year, I had tenure, I think. Yeah. Oh, no, 2 years. 2 years. I have that a little confused, but I know that by the time that I came to the University of Wisconsin, which was 10 years later, in 1972, I was already a full professor. So I could say I was at the University of Wisconsin for 28 years and never received a promotion.
Oh, that's very good.
So, at least they took me at my face value at the previous school. So I never had to be promoted here. So
Howard, how do you think about your Illinois years?
Those were very crucial years, because I had very tough colleagues, I would say. They had very high standards for themselves, and they expected high standards from their colleagues. And none of the faculty at the time had doctorates, but we were right in the midst of producing doctorates. And I'd say they were they pass judgment on others almost ruthlessly. And you know, if things weren't really perfect, they didn't pass them. It was almost as if they it was a very difficult school to secure a doctorate. And it's as if the piano faculty felt that no one was good enough to get a doctorate. And maybe it was because they didn't have doctorates then. I certainly didn't.
Uh-huh.
And the first one to receive the doctorate was hired eventually on the staff. And I would say the most distinguished piano colleague that I had when I was an active member was there at the University of Illinois. He had just received his master's degree, so he too was very young. And
who is
he
this?
Said Malcolm Bilson. Malcolm became quite a force in piano playing, and especially forte piano playing. He's like became the vanguard of the new look at the older music, in playing it in instruments that had the same qualities as the instruments of the composers who wrote for them.
Hmm.
And the whole forte piano school was very stimulating one. And during our 6 years together at the University of Illinois, Malcolm and I were very close friends, and I derived a great deal of inspiration from his playing and from him as a person. He had these wonderful ideas and so forth, but he had never played a forte piano yet. He left the University of Illinois in 68 to take a position at Cornell.
Uh-huh.
In other words, he went from a music department, a pianist, I say he went from a piano department in which he was a member, there were six of us, to a place where he was the piano department. It was a much smaller music school, but much more concentrated on older music and musicologically. They supported each other wonderfully. Mm-hmm. And so he developed a PhD program in musicology with a major in forte piano. And he was able to bring in gifted people from all over the world, just all over the world. And many Europeans in the staff. And I just went to his retirement festival, you might say. It was like a living festschrift that almost lasted a week.
Hmm.
And with tremendous support from Cornell. I mean, the president of Cornell gave a speech, and the provost, the members of the administration, and then the music department, the head of the music department. It was really very, very thrilling. And one day was devoted to a symposium of distinguished guests.
Wow.
Who came. So it was like a festschrift, you know. Instead of a book, it was just alive, and many, many concerts of his present students and his past students, and he played as well. And he's made so many wonderful recordings. I don't know, but he was just a great inspiration to have as a colleague there. And we've kept very close, we've kept our friendship very close all through the years. And I was so happy to go to his retirement. It was also his 70th birthday. So it was just very thrilling. And he's been here on campus several times at the University of Wisconsin.
So, Howard, I take it that that your colleagues set a very high bar.
Very high bar.
And you were comfortable with that.
Yes, I was very comfortable with that, and I was very happy. And they could be very critical of themselves and others, they weren't just friendly to everyone. They could be quite forbidding, and I think many gifted people came to grief not being able to secure their doctorate there after putting in a lot of time, because in the last analysis they weren't passed, and it wasn't because of the academic work, it was because of their piano playing. So I felt just I thought it was a little unfortunate for those people. I mean, if they were to be weeded out, I thought they should have been weeded out right away and not have spent so much time.
Oh.
But But someone like Malcolm was above all that. He got his doctorate. Just everyone knew how gifted he was, and what a distinguished musician he would become. So.
Did you give any thought at that time to going for a doctorate?
No, no. I felt I had a secure position, and I had no ambitions to go elsewhere. I thought I would spend the rest of my life at the University of Illinois. But I realized that after Malcolm left, it wasn't quite as stimulating for me in a certain way. And when the opportunity came, when the call came from the University of Wisconsin, I felt I was more needed there, here at the University of Wisconsin. See, Badura Skoda had taught here before I came. And Badura was a big, big pianist. Of course, Gunnar Johansson was a big pianist, too, who had been here since 1939, the first artist-in-residence at any major school in the country, especially a major university. And the Pro Arta Quartet came in 1940, the first quartet-in-residence at a major university.
Yes.
And they had quite a tradition. And the quartet at the University of Illinois was the Waldron Quartet, but they were not going, they were about to retire, and they were not going to be replaced. It was just a decision was made, and so that was another aspect of the University of Illinois that I didn't like, that after that many years of this long tradition, after all there was a quartet there in residence since 1947, if they were not going to replace them, it would make it less interesting for me.
Mm-hmm.
But then the University of Wisconsin had a string quartet that was basically their average age with my age. In fact, three of us were all born the same year.
Oh, really?
So I knew that if I would get the job at Wisconsin, I would be going to a school that was less developed than the University of Illinois, the music department I'm speaking of. It was a much later developed school. You know, when I came in 1972, it was not as far advanced as, say, the University of Illinois 10 years earlier when I joined their faculty.
Was that difficult for you? I mean, it was a little at first,
and of course I had doubts about whether I really wanted to leave. You know, I got letters from students who seemed to enjoy my audition here, and I felt there was more of a need for me here than at the University of Wisconsin of Illinois, and my children didn't think I was going to make the move. They say, "Oh, come on, Dad, you're just stalling. You know, you'll never leave Illinois. You just stay here the rest of your life." Well, that made me a little angry. So I just decided to go. And I didn't take a leave of absence from the university, as many people do, just to see whether they liked it or not. I just went, and I cut all ties with the University of Illinois.
Was it an adventure, or
yes,
was it?
It was an adventure. It was partly an adventure. And I had doubts after I came here, because I realized I didn't have students that were as good as the ones I had at Illinois. I mean, that was one of the great things about being at Illinois, is that I had a core of wonderful students.
Yes.
And I thought, well, maybe I wouldn't get students like that anymore. Well, something happened along the way. During my early years at the University of Wisconsin, the influx of Asian students became so strong that it completely transformed my class. And I began having more Asian students than Caucasian students.
Really?
And all of them were really quite magnificent. And I felt, in a way, if it weren't for my Asian students, I could just close up shop. Not that I didn't have some good ones who were not from Asia. But now, these were not second generation Asian students,
uh-huh,
whose parents had come, and these were people who left their native country to study in America. And the influx was very great. I think it was greater then than it is right now, since 9/11, because we've been hurting a little bit.
Yes.
Because it's much more difficult for European and Asian students to receive their visas and green cards and all that. Anyway, I soon forgot all about the University of Illinois.
Really?
I really settled into it very well. And after 4 years, my son came and joined the Pro Arta Quartet. And
where had Perry studied?
He studied for 1 year at the University of Michigan, and he loved it there, but he didn't care for his cello teacher that much. And he was there, he was majoring in cello as an applied major. And the summer before he started college, he went to Colby College in Maine, where the Hungarian String Quartet was in residence. Mm. And he just loved working with that group so much, and especially with the cellist, Gabriel Mudger. Well, it turned out that that summer was the last time the Hungarian String Quartet would be together. They were going to break up after many, many years together. And Mr. Mudger went to the University of Illinois.
Oh.
And so, had he known that, he would have applied to Illinois to study with Mudger. Well, he left the University of Michigan to return to the town that he grew up in, Urbana.
This is side two of tape three. Emeritus Professor of Music Howard Karp, April 12th, 2006.
So I'm just saying, having our oldest son as my colleague here made it so that I forgot all about Illinois in that sense, and never regretted for a moment that I left, because we just played all over the place together, and he was young, and he taught me so much. I mean, I was supposed to teach him, and I did what I could, but I don't know how successful I was in that, but it's what he taught me that was so great for me. So it was probably a
win-win.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Howard, talk about what you found here when you arrived in terms of the piano program.
Yes.
And well, how you built it.
Well, I one of the reasons they wanted me was they had lost a pianist of distinction. He had a 5-year contract, and he wasn't hired through the School of Music. It was some other arrangement that was made through the university as a whole, and it was not going to be renewed. And so they had a year here of no artist that took his place.
Oh,
you know. So but I think they felt the need of someone, and so. Officially, this was an added position in the School of Music at a time when they were not adding things anyplace, and especially in music, because it was the beginning of the, you might say, retraction from building, because it was the beginning of the budget crunch.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused the need, and when I found this special pleading from students that I had been exposed to during my audition period, I really took that into account. And at first, I was a little disappointed, as I said, because I wasn't aware of the talent being as fine as what I had. But it became better almost immediately. I mean, my second year was better than the first year, and my third year was better than the first 2 years, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it just got to be better and better. And I think a lot of that had to do with the Asian students. And I just felt very comfortable here. I'd say that my colleagues were a little more low-key than they were at the University of Illinois. You know, when we had faculty meetings there, we almost had to raise our hand, because the head of our area wanted to keep a very tight ship, and so we didn't all talk at once. You know, we talked in order at meetings, and when I came here, I noticed we all talked at the same time, and sometimes very little got done. But I enjoyed the relaxed atmosphere more. But when it came to our work, we were all very serious about what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Gunnar was in the last few years of his tenure, his long tenure here. And he didn't come to many of our meetings. But I must say, I had enormous respect for him. And he didn't have many piano students during his last 4 years here. But he had his big class on Friday afternoon. And I always reserved that time. I never taught during that hour so that I could attend his class.
Oh.
Because I got to hear him play in that. And I really admired his playing and the amount of playing that he could do. He had this enormous repertoire, one of the largest repertoires of any living pianist. It was interesting. He told me once, after a Rao played here, that they lived 2 blocks from each other in Berlin when they were students. And really? Both were aware of each other, but they never said a word to each other. And these two pianists, Claudio Rao and Gunnar Johansson, turned out to have one of the largest repertoires of any two pianists you could find. And to think that they were studying, with different teachers, of course, 2 blocks apart, I mean, living 2 blocks apart. One studied with a Liszt pupil, and the other studied with Busoni's greatest pupil, Egon Petri. Rao studied with Martin Krause, a student who had studied with Liszt, I believe, for just 1 year. But Rao studied with him from the time he was 7 to, I think he died when he was 18. I think Krause died when he was 18. So that was in 1918 also. Mm-hmm. And Gunnar studied there after the First World War, and he was let's see, Gunnar was 3 years younger than Rao. Rao was born the same year as Horowitz, 1903.
Oh, really?
You know, he passed away at that time when so many great pianists were expiring. Gunnar died in 91. I remember that, and I think Gunnar enjoyed a lifetime of health, and I think the only time he was ever ill was during his fatal illness, the last year of his life. He seemed such a happy individual.
So you and Gunnar got along?
We got along wonderfully, yes. I mean, I wasn't that close to him. I only went out to his house once, but we would have lunch together. He would come in just to have lunch, and as I said, I always attended his classes. Because there was always something there to learn, and I always found it so fascinating, you know, the repertoire that he would play for his class. And that was a class for non-music majors, basically.
Yes, I've heard alumni talk about that.
Oh, sure, yes.
Now, Howard, what are you doing with your repertoire at this point?
Well, I'm still learning. It's interesting that I've met, through my younger son, Christopher, at the University of Cincinnati, I have met a composer that he has become very friendly with, someone much younger than I, more contemporary with my children than with me. His name is Joel Hoffman, and he has written 2 trios for us, commissioned by Christopher. And we have played the 2 during our last 2 Labor Day programs.
Yes, I was going to say, I heard that last year.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, how wonderful. And he's writing a piece for all of us now.
Really?
He's writing a piece that includes 2 pianists, 2 pianos, and violin, cello, and viola, because Perry's wife is a violist.
Right.
So we hope to play that next year. He refers to it as a carptet.
Does he really?
So that's very nice. So I'm learning music of the 21st century. You know, and that's very thrilling. And, you know, I was very ill last year.
Yes.
And just felt very fortunate to get through that year, let alone to add to my repertoire. But I did get to play about a year ago now, early April, because I couldn't play before that. And I just feel so fortunate that I can play again, and was able. And of course, I don't think I could have made it without Francis' devoted help to me, and devotion medically and every other way. And the boys were terrific. just everywhere. You know, there's just something very wonderful about having a doctor in the family, because he helped with his advice. You know, he's no surgeon, but with his advice, I'm sure he pulled me through, or helped pull me through, my surgeon followed his advice. Because I needed an emergency surgery, and then it wasn't successful, and he saw to it that I had a follow-up surgery.
Well, tell Christopher, for me, I'm grateful because we can do this interview.
Exactly. That's so wonderful.
Well, Howard, talk, if you would, about the development and evolution of the annual Karp Family Concert, which has become a real highlight of the School of Music.
I'm aware of that. That, you know, people really attend that concert.
Yes.
In a way that's just amazing, because we started it when Perry joined the string quartet, the Pro Art Quartet, in 1976.
Oh.
He was just 21 years old, and the arrangement was that he would do his master's degree with the previous member of the Pro Art Quartet, Lowell Kreitz, and Lowell, I think, wanted out of the quartet, had been in it since 1956 or so, Perry had played all of his Illinois recitals at the Unitarian Church, which we would rent on Sunday afternoons, about a week ahead of the performances at the University of Illinois. And so the members of the quartet got to hear him play and were very impressed with his playing. And so that's why they asked him to join, because Lowell wanted, and it worked out just as beautifully as it could have been. Anyway, I do remember that when I was a student at Oberlin, and during my freshman year, and I think during my senior year, that the faculty members put on a concert before the regular concert season started. And they were both just wonderful concerts. And I thought, you know, we're in a position to do that. Our family's now in a position to do that. Why don't we give a concert and just see how it goes as a family? But I really had the Oberlin experience in mind. And so in 1976, during Perry's first year, we gave a concert. But we had no idea it was going to be an annual event. And, you know, we just did this year after year, and about the 10th time, we began to number it and say, the 10th Labor Day program. We thought Labor Day was a wonderful day because it was usually the day before school began.
Yes.
And everyone was here, and there was nothing else to do, we thought. So it would be a good time to bring people together. And, but the next one will be number 30.
Oh my God.
Now, it's not 30 years in a row, because my illness in 2004 prevented the number 29 from occurring.
Uh-huh.
So there was a 2-year lapse then between 28 and 29. And so we did it in 2005.
How do you and the family decide what you're going to play?
Well, somehow, first of all the concerts have always been pieces that have never been played by us before on that concert. In other words, have been 29 concerts in which there has been no repetition. So we first think of pieces that we haven't played.
Uh-huh.
And when you do it for 29 years, you have to eliminate a lot of music.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that we never necessarily played it. Sometimes we're playing things for the first time, and sometimes we're playing things maybe for the 16th time. But they've never been played on that opening concert for us. And we try to have a variety of things. And for the first time last year, our oldest granddaughter took part, because she and her younger sister are both very active members of the young Shakespeare players here in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And they do complete works of Shakespeare.
Yes.
And so they have, Ariana has the poise to go out on stage and do this, even though she's still in high school. And we're hoping to do something like that again. with both girls.
Uh-huh.
On the 30th.
Wonderful.
There's a long epic poem by Tennyson called Enoch Arden, and Strauss set Enoch Arden into not a song cycle, but as a melodrama, because they're not singers, they're speakers, they're actresses for piano and speakers. And so the girls are going to share that, and Frances and I are going to share the piano duties.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, Strauss, of course, did that in a German translation with a famous German actor in the old days. How are we doing for time, dear? Are we nearing there?
Howard, if you would just say again about the publicity that came when you reached the 10th.
We got some extra publicity because of that round number when we told Jake Stockinger that, because he's the man that puts all of this in the paper and writes it up on, you know, in the rhythm section of the local papers. We're really very proud of this skein of so many, and you know, we have really I think attracted a following through the years for that, and I think people are hungry to hear music, live music again, because of the summer hiatus and so forth.
I certainly became aware of it early on, when I was working for the symphony, the start of classical music season was the Karp Family Concert.
Of course. Now the symphony, the Madison Symphony, has their first rehearsal on the night of our concert. Despite the fact of being Labor Day, they work that night.
Is that right?
Because their first concert is the following weekend.
It
started last week, last season, and I know it's going to happen this season too, as well. I must say the move that I made from the University of Illinois to the University of Wisconsin, I have absolutely no regrets about making that. I might have had a few right at the beginning because I wasn't quite sure,
uh-huh.
but I think I've been much happier here than I would have been had I stayed there.
Howard, can you comment on any of your students here at Wisconsin, or perhaps at Illinois, who have gone on to particularly outstanding careers?
Well, I don't think I've had any student who has made a worldwide career, but I've had many students who have key positions at universities, in other words, doing the same basic thing that I do, performing and teaching, and I'm very proud of them. I think one of the first was Michael Zenga. He was an Oberlin graduate, and I had him at Illinois, and a very distinguished artist. And he retired the same year I retired, even though he was younger,
really?
You know, a generation earlier. Most of my Asian students have some position. If it's not full-time, it's at least part-time. And most of those are in Korea,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's difficult when you have a small country, and basically music schools are in one city, the capital city of Seoul. There are lots of colleges there, but there are so many Korean pianists of distinction that have doctorates from all over the world, and they return to this one city. At least we have the whole country to try to secure a position in.
Uh-huh.
Not that it's difficult, not that it's easy, because there's always been more people qualified to handle these positions than there are positions. And so many people in music end up teaching privately,
uh-huh.
and trying to make a career outside of the university. But I would say that I've been here the longest of any position I've had. I mean, I was officially on the faculty for 28 years.
Uh-huh.
And I've had just so many people that have gotten advanced degrees at the University of Wisconsin.
Howard, have you observed a change for the better or worse in terms of the quality of the students
It's better. It's better all the time.
Really?
And it's even better since I haven't been here because we have more scholarship money now available to bring people, and we have this very distinguished pianist, Christopher Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a world-class talent, and he really draws people.
Uh-huh.
And so do other faculty members as well.
Howard, but I will want to ask you about your opinion of the School of Music over the years, mm-hmm. but before we do that, we didn't really address your second sabbatical in Vienna, how that came about and what you did during it.
We all so enjoyed being there our first year, the year from Kentucky, that there was no question, I just wanted to return. And we lived a little farther out, so it wasn't as accessible as it was when we lived there the first time, but we still heard lots and lots of things. And, we enjoyed ourselves, again, the same way. Now, I didn't study officially with a teacher. I wasn't in a curriculum. But after the year in Vienna was over, I did go, and let me say that I played this time. I had a tour of Europe, of five capitals. I gave a recital in Vienna, and then Berlin, and London, Brussels, and Amsterdam. And that I got tremendous satisfaction from doing that. That was the first tour I ever had away from the university communities. These were all concert halls, in the center of town. And
what year was this?
This was 1968.
Okay.
It was in November of 1968. And I got some really wonderful reviews, I must say, from the playing. And it led to more performances in Europe when I came back to America, and then when I came to Wisconsin, all because of that year. Well, I also got to go to Poland to play in Warsaw.
Were you playing on that tour?
Well, it was a big, big program. I played the Copland Piano Variations, which is a very spiny piece. It's Copland, the most avant-garde, I think, from 1930. Very individualistic piece. And I realized that I scared a lot of people away. I had to win them back for the rest of the program. But not the Americans. There were Americans in the audience. They just loved that. But it was a little harsh for non-Americans, I think. But it was the only place for it on the program, because it were just three big stakes. And I played the Hammerklavier Sonata of Beethoven,
uh-huh.
which is Beethoven's biggest sonata. And then I played the Liszt Sonata.
Uh-huh.
Which has been one of my big pieces for a long time, one of my pieces. And there's a recording of that that's available. When I retired, I had a former student who produced a two-record album, my solo playing, and that included this sonata. I mean, that's through the years. It's like a cross-section of my playing through the years. From different periods in my life.
Again, this may be an uninformed question. Were you nervous at all before that tour?
Oh, sure I was nervous. The responsibility was enormous because I was going to get reviews. But of course, I was unknown. And so the halls were papered. That means that they give out tickets to people without charging for them. And in a sense, I paid for the tour. I paid for the rental of the hall. I paid for the manager to do his work of printing tickets and printing programs and arranging all the things that one arranges. But in 1968, 69, things were much less expensive than they are today. You know, today, perhaps you'd have to, for a 5-date tour, you'd probably have to pay as much as I paid for the whole tour for one concert, if you're an unknown. In other words, I didn't have a true manager who maybe took a portion I got the ticket receipts, but they weren't that great in return, that's all. But I paid for the printing and all everything. And the manager got his cut. Well, I didn't mind that at all. Because we had saved for doing that. And I was getting older, and I just wanted to have that experience. And
it must have been thrilling.
Yes, and then later I got to, as a result of the tour, I got to play with the Amsterdam Philharmonic Orchestra. And Francis and I together got to play with the Hague Residency Orchestra in Leiden, the Mozart Double Concerto. And so it led to other things that were really very nice. And
you were still based at Illinois then?
No, I was basically based here then. That happened when I was here. I guess the Amsterdam Philharmonic occurred when I was at Illinois, my last year at Illinois. So, but since then I've been invited to places like the Maryland Festival to perform, and to the American List Society, and I played for them this year.
Oh, you did?
At their convention in Athens, Georgia. It was at the University of Georgia. And I landed in Atlanta, and I took the bus over to Athens. And that was good for me, because after all of my illness, I at first didn't know whether I would be up to learning something new that I had never played before, never even taught a wonderful work by Liszt that I remember hearing as a youngster, but hadn't heard very often through the years. And I never taught the second ballade in a group of ballades of Liszt and his pupils. Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting session, I thought. And I've also been invited to play in Asia, in Shenyang. And then my former students from Korea invited me to play there.
And did you?
Oh, yes. That was in 94. So I've had some nice bonuses from, that initial tour, I'd say. And I feel very thankful that I can still play, because a lot of people, when they get to a certain age, are afflicted by arthritis and so forth, and different diseases that age brings on that prevent them from playing.
Well, you look like you're in great shape. As I stood outside trying to get in, I could hear Howard playing. This concludes side two of tape 3.